Welcome to Dead Writer Drama, where we talk about the professional feuds, sex scandals, messy public breakups, and controversial legacies of history's literary legends. Brought to you by the American Writers Museum.
Hi, I'm Zakiya Dalila Harris. My debut novel, The Other Black Girl, is available now from Atria Books in the U.S. and Bloomsbury Books in the U.K.
And I'm Jennifer Cation Armstrong. I've written 7 books about pop culture history, including the New York Times bestseller Seinfeldia and When Women Invented Television.
New York Times, December 1st, 1987. James Baldwin, whose passionate, intensely personal essays in the 1950s and 60s on racial discrimination in America helped break down the nation's color barrier, died of cancer last night at his home in southern France. He was 63 years old. At least in the early years of his career, Mr. Baldwin saw himself primarily as a novelist, but it is his essays that arguably constitute his most substantial contribution to literature. Mr. Baldwin published his 3 most important collections of essays, Notes of a Native Son, 1955, Nobody Knows My Name, 1961, and The Fire Next Time, 1963, during the years when the civil rights movement was exploding across the American South. Some critics said his language was sometimes too elliptical, his indictments sometimes too sweeping. But then Mr. Baldwin's prose, its apocalyptic tone, a legacy of early exposure to religious fundamentalism, and his passionate yet distant sense of advocacy seemed perfect for a period in which Blacks in the South lived under continual threat of racial violence and in which civil rights workers often faced brutal beatings and even death.
Mr. Baldwin had moved to France in the late 1940s to escape what he felt was the stifling racial bigotry of America. Nonetheless, although France remained his permanent residence, Mr. Baldwin in later years described himself as a commuter rather than an expatriate. Only white Americans can consider themselves to be expatriates, he said. Once I found myself on the other side of the ocean, I could see where I came from very clearly, and I could see that I carried myself, which is my home, with me. You can never escape that. I am the grandson of a slave, and I am a writer. I must deal with both.
In this episode, we'll be discussing James Baldwin, the iconic essayist and novelist who was also crowned a spokesman for the civil rights movement, though he resisted that designation. Born in 1924, Baldwin grew up in Harlem, influenced, of course, by the Harlem Renaissance and taught by Renaissance writer County Cullen. Baldwin said of his own coming of age, "I knew I was Black, of course, but I also knew I was smart. I didn't know how I would use my mind, or even if I could, but that was the only thing I had to use." His first published work, a review of the writer Maxim Gorky, appeared in The Nation in 1947. He famously moved to Paris at age 24, where he wrote his first semi-autobiographical novel, Go Tell It on the Mountain, in 1952. His seminal collection of essays, Notes of a Native Son, was published in 1955. He returned to the United States in the summer of 1957 and lived in Greenwich Village during the late 1950s and early 1960s. During that time, he published Giovanni's Room, a novel that was controversial due to its bisexual main character and its depiction of his love affairs with men. Another Country in 1962 and Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone in 1968 also included interracial relationships, extramarital affairs, and characters of varying sexualities, all still quite taboo at the time. Meanwhile, by the spring of 1963, the mainstream press began to recognize Baldwin as a leading Black voice on the burgeoning civil rights movement and race relations in America. He even appeared on the cover of Time magazine's May 17, 1963 issue. The magazine said, "There is not another writer who expresses with such poignancy and abrasiveness the dark realities of the racial ferment in North and South." He resisted the idea of being the spokesperson for an entire race. He preferred to see himself as simply bearing witness to the truth of the time, but he also took his stature seriously, speaking difficult truths when necessary.
Our guest today is Robert Jones Jr., author of The Prophets, which came out in January 2021. We're going to hear from him in his own words about what The Prophets is about, but we both love it. And if that isn't enough to convince you, Jones has had mountains and mountains of praise for the book already. It has been called an extraordinary, vivid novel written with heart and imagination by NPR and by the New York Times, an often lyrical and rebellious love story embedded within a tender call out to Black readers. And The Guardian has said, It is not hyperbole to say that The Prophets, which explores Black queer lives on a Mississippi plantation known among the enslaved as Empty, evokes the best of Toni Morrison while also being its own distinct and virtuosic work. It is hard to believe this is a debut. Robert Jones Jr. is from New York City. He received his BFA in creative writing and MFA in fiction from Brooklyn College. He has written for numerous publications, including the New York Times, Essence, and the Paris Review. He is the creator and curator of the social justice social media community Son of Baldwin, which has over 275,000 members across platforms. The Prophets is, in fact, his debut novel, even though the critics could not believe it. And we can't either. It's so good.
It's so good.
It was such a treat to sort of have to read this for this. And I wanted to do that thing where I wanted to like keep highlighting quotes and then quote them back to him in this interview, but I knew that would get annoying after a while. But it's just really, really beautiful lyrical prose and these images, and just, you're so into the characters. I can't take it.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to do the same, but instead of doing that for our interview, which you will all hear soon, I quoted other parts of Robert Jones's work. His writing is just so vivid and gorgeous and really excited for everyone to hear. But Jennifer, I have to ask, when did you first encounter James Baldwin?
Yes, we have to. I feel like we end up talking about this with all of our authors now, but that's critical to the whole point, right? And this is one that's so interesting to me because I grew up in a super white place. I don't know if I met a Black person until high school. And we did not, like, it's just, as far as I know, this just did not exist. Baldwin was not part of the conversation. I mean, we did do the Toni Morrison. Like, we had, like, the couple that you would, like, have to do, essentially. Right. Mm-hmm. But that's it. And so it really wasn't somewhat till college. I would say essays in college, in more like, you know, classes about, now it wasn't like literature class, right? It was classes about, you know, the civil rights movement, probably that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it really didn't get into him until this kind of renaissance that we talked about with Robert, that, like, you know, Baldwin has really kind of come into his own and we finally appreciate what we had all these years later. How about you?
Yeah, yeah. I also grew up mostly around white people. and I know I must have heard the name, knew the name. I feel like possibly in high school I might have had an encounter, but the fact that I can't remember says a lot. Because I do remember encountering other like Black authors, Zora Neale Hurston, Octavia Butler in high school. James Baldwin, for me, didn't really come into the picture. I mean, kind of in college, but really in grad school when I did my MFA at the New School. I remember reading Notes of a Native Son for the very first time, and the essay. And it really spoke to me for various reasons. In the podcast, I mentioned that he came to me at a certain time. I mean, it was like 2015, protests were happening in New York, Philando Castile, had been murdered on camera. Eric Garner's police officer who murdered him was free and nothing was happening. And all of those things were going on. And I remember reading this essay and James Baldwin talking about, you know, his dad being really distrustful of white people and saying, you know, they can kind of be nice, but like, no, like this is not, they're not good. And James Baldwin reflecting on how he was like, but that's not possible. Like that, like he up until a certain point had not had that kind of experience. And then he mentions later on, like moments of going to, in Princeton, I believe it was, going to the counter with his white friends and picking up on the fact that like he wasn't being served, and suddenly having just this awareness that continues throughout the essay. And I know for me, I also experienced a similar thing of, growing up around white people, not really thinking, being privileged enough not to think about racism in that way until years later, I finally realized it doesn't matter how privileged I was. You know, I am a Black woman living in the US. So that was really, for me, that essay and a lot of his writing just like blew open my own conceptions about race and you know, the way we talk about race. So really excited to chat with Robert Jones Jr. today.
Yes, please enjoy our absolutely delightful conversation with a delightful human being.
Yes. So without further ado, we will get this show going. So Robert Jones Jr., this is amazing. First and foremost, I am so excited to finally be meeting you. I have been hearing nothing but amazing things about your novel, The Prophets. And now that I have read it, I mean, it's beyond lived up to the hype. The characters are so vivid. And so many times I read this book and just like went, ugh, like so many emotions. Beautifully, beautifully done. So as I said, Prophets blew both of us away. So can you tell listeners in your own words what The Prophets is about?
Thank you for that wonderful introduction, Zakiya. And it means so much coming from someone who wrote The Other Black Girl, who is the book that they're calling the best of the year. And it just came out. So
thank you
so much. The Prophets is a story about Samuel and Isaiah, two enslaved young men on a plantation in Antebellum, Mississippi. The twist here is that they are in love with one another. And the book revolves around, reverberates through time, how that love affects everyone around them, whether also enslaved or enslaver, and sort of ripples back through the past to show that their love has this lineage. And it's really about the power of love. At its core.
Yeah, I love that. Love having lineage. So good.
In the author bio that we gave listeners, we mentioned that you are the creator and curator of an online community called Son of Baldwin. Can you speak a little bit about that? Why Baldwin? How did this first start going for you?
Absolutely. So, full disclosure, I got to Baldwin rather late in my life because I am myself a late bloomer. So I didn't really full-heartedly go to college until I was 31 years old because of various issues around personal situations with me coming to terms with my own queerness, bullying and all of these other things, and having to make a living for myself at a relatively young age. I did not have time for school. But once I decided that writing was my purpose and I fully committed myself to college, my very first semester, I'm taking a political science course, and who am I introduced to but James Baldwin? And so this is someone that I've heard the name, but I didn't even know what he looked like. I didn't know he was Black. I didn't know he was queer, none of that. So I'm reading this essay called Here Be Dragons, which is one of his last essays before he passed away. And I'm just blown away by the utter brilliance of what I'm writing. And so from that, I said, I have to find every single thing this man wrote and read it from start to finish. And that is what I did. And was wondering at the time, and this was like in maybe 2002, why he wasn't more celebrated in the culture. He is now, he's experienced such a wonderful renaissance and he rolls off the lips and the tongue now. But back then he was sort of hidden. He was obviously spoken about in academic areas, but outside of that, not so much. And so after having read all of his work and thought about his importance, I sort of adopted him as a spiritual godfather. After all, he's Black, he's queer, he's from New York City, and he's a writer, all the things that I am or wanted to be. And I watched this documentary in about 2007 on PBS about Baldwin's life. And toward the end of that documentary, Baldwin's brother says this line that devastates me as he's talking about his last conversation with Baldwin in his deathbed. Baldwin said to his brother, "I hope someone finds me in the wreckage." And I just said, "Oh, what if they don't find him in the wreckage? I'm going to create a blog called Son of Baldwin, where we discuss him, his work, and all of the issues, political and otherwise, that he brought to bear." And that's what I did. In 2007, I started this blog on Blogspot. And in 2008, 2009, moved it to Facebook when that was starting to become a little bit more popular. And the rest was kind of history. Word of mouth, it spread. And now there's like over 280,000 followers across platforms. And it has been such an education for me, getting to speak to people from different walks of life, from all over the world, under the banner of Blackness and queerness, and as well as other gender issues as well.
That's really lovely. It almost, I mean, I might be bringing too much woo-woo into this, but it feels to me like it's like you were meant to be. It's like, it feels like that was a great age for you to discover him. I think sometimes if we discover stuff later, it's like the right, you know, you can understand it better and appreciate it, I guess, more better. And then it's like the perfect time. It's like blogs are just happening and social media is just happening. And then the Baldwin kind of renaissance you mentioned is just happening. So it feels like you and Baldwin were just meant to be.
Let me tell you, Jennifer, I'm here for the woo-woo. I totally, totally believe in something larger than us at play, and that nothing is a coincidence, and that all of this stuff was really, truly meant to be. And I agree with you that I got to Baldwin at the right time in my life. I went back to college at the right time in my life because I realized why I was there. I wasn't going just because I graduated high school and that was what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I was going there because I had a purpose and I wanted to see it through to its conclusion.
Totally. He was speaking through you. I'm here for the woo-woo too. I have chills. Just like I'm sitting by the fan, and it's not the chills from the fan. I have to say, I came to Baldwin, I think, in a similar way of finding him at a time where it was just the perfect moment. And I think really, you know, I think a lot about how now today, of course, he's everywhere. We know his name, people outside of academia know his name, but I think it's easy to forget that wasn't always the case, like you mentioned, of remembering him through the wreckage. So yeah, thank you for sharing that.
Thank you.
This also makes me think about, you know, when I was reading the prophets, I kept thinking, because of Son of Baldwin, as like, how proud, I think, I mean, I'm just speaking for him now, but like, I feel like he would be so proud to see that this could be out in the world, to see that he had paved the way for this, to see that he had inspired this. How do you think his work kind of, you know, paved the way directly to you writing the prophets?
You know, I'm choking up when you're saying this, because one of my dreams is that James Baldwin and my other spiritual god parent, Toni Morrison, would have gotten to read this book so that they could tell me that if it had any value, if it did what it needed to do, if I was on the right path. I cannot tell you how much he meant to me as a writer, and how much of an impact and influence he's had on me in the prophets as well as Toni Morrison. I don't think I could have created this book without the paths that they paved. I could not have done it. They introduced me to a way to think about the English language in a way that was never done before, in a way that was wholly Black and queer, and sort of broke open language and made it into something that was not just lyrical and poetic and beautiful, but also cosmic and spiritual and large, and so much larger than the words themselves. They hold meaning beyond just the letters that make them up. And I am so thankful for both of them. And my one regret is that they could not have, they were not here to read this.
Oh, I know that they would. I mean, from what I know, I just know they would be so proud. I know while reading The Prophets, I felt them while reading it. Your book and the interviews and the pieces that you've written, I always feel this sense of community radiating from your words, you know, Black writer community specifically. And you wrote this beautiful letter I found on Son of Baldwin to Ava DuVernay in 2015, I believe it was, for Shadow and Act, but you thankfully, I'm so glad, put it on your blog again. And I don't know, I always think, again, as an author, I think it's hard to find community a lot of times, I think, especially when we're all online. And so, you know, to see things like this, pieces like this that speak to other artists in this way, like this letter does, was just really touching for me to see. And I'm gonna read a quote for you, and then I have a question, I promise. I'm not just rambling. Okay, so. Like in Toni Morrison's literary canon, when you say people, you mean Black people. You have given us the joyous opportunity to be the default. Flesh and blood and brain and bone, sly and raucous, shining and fretful, rhythmic and flawed, quiet and funky, loud, honey, and shaking groove things. Beautiful, but most importantly, ordinary. The fantasy of being a regular old human being, a basic principle that Hollywood has, since its inception, denied Black people. Instead, it has been doing the insidious work that I suppose any white supremacist society is charged with doing if it wishes to remain white supremacist, disseminating half-truths and half-lives, making us the ooga booga and other things that go bump at midnight in the homes of white folk, or conversely, sexless, smiling, supernatural, sage servants who exist only to make white people's lives more livable, rewarding mightily the complicit among us. Oh, yeah, that, when I say I hear Toni Morrison in your work, like in your words, oh man, I could pull apart that paragraph for days. But my question to you is a question that is a loaded one, I think, and might be difficult sometimes to answer, but what do you think is the what do you think is the responsibility of the Black artist to Black consumers? And also, what do you think the responsibility is to Black artists, other Black artists within the community?
The responsibility I think the Black artist has to the Black viewer or the Black consumer is to tell the truth. Whether that truth is sweet or bitter, whether it is embracing or chastising, the truth has to be told. That is my job as the artist, because for me, truth is the way to liberation. Toni Morrison said, when you get free, your job is to free someone else. That's it. Yes. So I wholeheartedly believe that philosophy. And then in terms of my responsibility to other artists, if I got in the door, my job is to hold it open for the next person to come through. And I am the recipient of that. Kiese Layman, the author of Long Division, Heavy, and so many other great works. My book would not have been published if not for Kiese seeing it, telling his agent, this guy has some talent, and that agent then taking Kiese at his word. And then for me, it's the same when M. Shelley Connor or Dante Stewart come to me and ask for favors, for advice, I give it. Anything I could do, any doors I can open for you, please. Because although the industry, and this applies to many industries, not just publishing, sets us up as competition, because as Dantiel Moniz of Milk, Blood, Heat and I have discussed, there can only be one woman, one Black person, one queer person, whatever it is, there can only be one, but I reject that. And I have formed a community of other Black artists who also likewise reject that and say, instead of competition, we are community. And that is the only way I can operate. I will not operate any other way. I will not be pit up against other artists. I will not.
Yeah, that's, I mean, we could talk about publishing, I'm sure, for a long time, especially with Zakiya's book about publishing, which I'm reading currently. So it's like very in my head. But yeah, it's a whole, it's its own thing. And that's so beautiful to hear, because I think publishing needs more of that from all kinds of people.
Definitely.
You know, because it feels competitive. They make us feel competitive all the time about everything. So that's really lovely. Switching gears to Baldwin, what would you say is one of the biggest misconceptions about Baldwin as a writer or a human? I feel like he struggled with this even within his own lifetime. He sort of spoke about being misunderstood. What do you think is most misunderstood about him?
I think what's most misunderstood about Baldwin is this idea that he was sort of like a pretend, like he could predict the future. What I would say is that Baldwin was just an astute observer of human behavior, so good that it looked like he was predicting future behavior, but he just simply knew human beings at their core, what they were and how they operate and the ways in which power corrupts and where that leads. So it's easy to see patterns when you understand the behavior and why the behavior is as it is. I think that is what's most misunderstood about Baldwin. What he did wasn't magic. It was wonderful, astute, brilliant, scholarly observation and work. That's what it was. It wasn't anything mystical for the most part. It was-
That we know of.
That we know of, right. It was just rigorous intelligence and astute observations about humanity.
Yeah, and that's, thank you. I mean, and that's what we really, I think through this podcast too, we want to get across about the authors that we're talking about is like, they are people, they are humans. There are flaws, there are, you know, obviously all of the amazing accolades, but those all go hand in hand. I think that's really important to remember.
I remember Nikki Giovanni and Audre Lorde letting Baldwin know what some of his flaws were.
Yes. Yes. I stumbled across on YouTube actually a couple days ago, a video of them, Nikki Giovanni and Baldwin talking that I'd never seen before. And right after I started watching that video, I went onto Twitter or something and did something, and Twitter reminded me that day was Nikki Giovanni's birthday. And you brought me to, I mean, it's like, there's that woo-woo again. It's like very strange. Anyway, next question, again, chills. So I actually learned a fact that I didn't know about in terms of, I have to say, full disclaimer, I have not read Giovanni's Room yet. I know. It's terrible. It's on the list. It's like one of those things. I've read a lot of his essays. I studied nonfiction in my MFA program, so I read a lot of Baldwin's nonfiction, but I'm still dipping my toe into other works that are not nonfiction. So, but I was listening to this, a podcast about it, and they're talking about the fact that the character is a white man, and it's mostly white people. I think everyone is white in the book.
Yes.
And I promise as soon as I'm going to read it, but that was really fascinating to me. So then I found another interview, you know, as you fall down rabbit holes, and he's talking about the characters in the book, and he says, "What I certainly could not possibly have, not at that point in my life, handled the other great weight, the Negro problem. The sexual moral light was a hard thing to deal with. I could not handle both propositions in the same book. There was no room for it. I might do it differently today, but then to have a Black presence in the book at that moment and in Paris would have been quite beyond my powers." So I think this also makes me think of the last point you made of he's human, right? He only can do so much. And I found this moment really interesting that he admitted he couldn't, just could not grapple with both on the page or didn't feel comfortable at the moment doing that. And so my question for you is, you know, what do you think Baldwin would say about representation of queerness in today's literature, but also in other forms of media? Do you think it's gotten better? Do you think the space has gotten more accepting or given more flexibility for that kind of conversation that he couldn't really bring to the table back then?
That's a really good question. The first hint of queerness that I encounter in a timeline of history is in Wallace Thurman's The Black or the Berry, which he wrote in 1929. And then he wrote another book subsequently that went on it full on. And those books have, for the most part, not received the kind of attention that I would imagine he was dealing with these issues in 1929. Like, why aren't we like, yo, this is a central text. This should be celebrated in the canon. So the fact that we can now look at, like, for example, a Marlon James writing about Blackness and queerness, or a Nicole Dennis Benn writing about Blackness and queerness and celebrate it, does mean that there was some movement. Because I can imagine James Baldwin writing in the 50s, Giovanni's Room, and not wanting to reckon with Blackness and queerness, particularly because he's under the scrutiny of other Black men who have decided that queerness somehow emasculates manhood. And right now, Black men need to be men in the most patriarchal sense imaginable. And he did not want that fight. And that's what I hear in between the lines of what you read about him, is that I did not want to have to fight the Black community too.
Yeah. Yeah, so many layers. There's just so many layers.
Baldwin was known for his essays. I feel like that's the thing we all read, right? For if you were like assigned him at all, this is what you got first, especially in his own lifetime, even more so. But he seemed to like writing novels better from what I have read of him talking about his work. Which do you think is the more potent form of commentary today, since you wrote a beautiful big novel? And do you think that has changed since Baldwin's time?
I may be biased, although I do write essays too. Mm-hmm. But I do think the novel is the most potent, only because it creates an entire world for the reader to get lost in. And so that world will stay with you longer. It will impact you in a more fuller way. Like, I'm thinking about essays I read as a kid and I can't remember them, but I remember Charlotte's Web. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I still tear up thinking about poor Charlotte, you know? I think there's something about the way fiction impacts us, because human beings love a story. That seems to be something that's intrinsic to humankind. And so when you can put all of these messages, sociopolitical and other, into this story form, I think it makes it more transformative and more impactful. And also, all of these scientific studies I've read say that the more fiction you read, the more empathetic you become. Mm-hmm. So I think it's in the realm of fiction.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've read studies too about television and film that say something similar, that even that people have more empathy for groups that are not like themselves when they get to know these characters on an individual level and, you know, immerse themselves versus being told, right? Like, you should be nice to these people. Right. Instead, they, you know, immigrant groups, those sorts of things, they've done studies on sitcoms about immigrant groups, for instance, and found that it really actually changed people. So you might be, I think you're onto something there.
Yes.
Awesome. And, you know, I'm so sorry. I want to ask you another question, Robert, that I meant to ask you before. Please bear with me. if it's okay, I feel like this question is one I want to know what your answer is. I want to know what your answer is to all of them, but this is one specifically I'm so curious about. Is there anything, so since Baldwin was a film TV culture critic, I guess we'll say, wrote lots of book reviews, had lots to say about what was on, what people were watching, what people are consuming. Is there anything today you think he would point at and be like, I'm so happy this exists, besides The Prophets, which I, again, think he definitely would point at?
In general, I think he would love the bold number of Black people writing. I think that would please him immensely. If I had to think of one specific work that he might have really liked, I think he would have really loved Moonlight, the movie.
Yes.
I think he would have enjoyed that film because of the way it deals with masculinity and the framing of manhood and how queerness offers us a way out of that patriarchal way of thinking about manhood, which is always synonymous with violence. So I think he would have really been pleased by the beauty of that film.
Definitely. And it's so poetic too.
Oh, yes.
And nuanced, and the music in it. So I can see that too.
Lovely.
Thank you so much. Well, now we're gonna shimmy on into our lightning round questions. a little lighter. So our first question is, which work of his besides If Beale Street Could Talk, which was made into Barry Jenkins' film in 2018, which is such a good film, which work of Baldwin's would make the best modern movie or TV adaptation?
Ooh, that's a great question. That's a hard question too. Another Country. I think Another Country would make a great novel. There's a scene in that book where he describes a friend, and it's based on a true story, who dies by suicide. He leaps off of a bridge, and the beauty in which he and the sadness in which he describes in that scene, it's very cinematic to me. So I think Another Country would be the one.
Excellent. I hope people get on that. If Beale Street Could Talk proves that we need more Baldwin adaptations for sure. So now, even simpler question, paperback, hardcover, or audiobook, which would be Baldwin's preferred method of reading?
Hardcover, because he's Baldwin after all. He doesn't have that mid-Atlantic accent for no reason, darling.
I'm glad you came with the Baldwin
yes.
impression. We needed that.
Seriously needed that. So good. And now, which, if any, form of social media would he prefer? Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok?
Baldwin, being as loquacious as he is, would prefer Facebook.
No character count.
he would not be limited by that.
And what would he have most likely taken up as a quarantine pastime? Sourdough bread, knitting, a new language, puzzles, or something else?
You know, I could see Baldwin sitting on a nice couch in his den, knitting. I could literally see that in my head, in that his tiny frame just up against the couch with Bessie Smith playing in the background as he's knitting.
Love it.
Yes. I would just watch a movie of him knitting, to be honest. Great.
And listening to Bessie Smith.
I miss you.
Perfect.
Totally.
Perfect. Well, that is it. Thank you so much. This was such a joy. Where can people visit you online?
I can be found on Facebook at Son of Baldwin FB, on Instagram at The Son of Baldwin, and on Twitter at Son of Baldwin.
Excellent. Thank you so much. This was a joy and a pleasure.
Yes.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you. And also, again, go read The Prophets, everyone, if you have not yet. It is spectacular, and you will just get pulled into it immediately. So check it out.
Absolutely.